Bibles tonight, I'd like to ask you to turn them to John chapter 2. We'll spend a few minutes in this passage and then some more, Lord willing, in a few other passages to help us with the topic that I mentioned this morning, something that always comes up and people ask about and wonder and say, well, this or well, that, we'll see. What we find, and I hope you'll clearly understand what I understand from the Scriptures, at least in summary fashion, as we go along here. The Bible tells us in John chapter 2, let me just read the first two verses, "And the third day there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage." Now, back in chapter 1 and verse 43, it told us that Jesus would go into Galilee. That was the day before this day here in chapter 2 and verse 1. And so he's set out to go to this wedding. Weddings don't just pop up, of course. They take great planning. And so he had an invitation. He was, as it says, called to the wedding, and his disciples, and as we'll see, well, as it says here, and then the mother of Jesus was there as well. So this is the fifth day, actually. It says the third day from when John started counting, but Of all that we've seen in John's gospel, there's been a total of 5 days, starting way back from when John the Baptist was questioned by the messengers from Jerusalem sent by the Levites and the priests sent by the Pharisees. And so, you know, John just keeps rolling along here, telling what is happening in the very beginning of the Lord's ministry. And so here it is, very simply, they were invited to this wedding. Now, he went to this wedding. He just went there, and of course, there was something for him to do, but he did take up the invitation and go. Now, we start getting into the meat of it here in verse 3, where it says, "And when they wanted," or it really means when they ran out of, when they lacked wine, "the mother of Jesus said unto him, They have no wine." Now, this is a real problem. I mean, when you're at a wedding in this culture and there's no wine, it's like if we were at a wedding today, and I was just thinking, who could I use for an illustration? Well, someone who is helping, with the wedding, one of our ladies, you know, and they come to the person who's in charge of all the arrangements and say, you know, look, we ran out of cake. And the person says, well, just cut them smaller. Well, we already cut them as small as we could, and they're all gone. And half the people haven't even had it yet. And what do you do? Oh, my, this is a problem. Well, they ran out of cake. Well, they ran out of wine, here is the situation. And so Jesus' mother, Mary, is obviously involved somehow in the, you know, wedding. Maybe she's one of the women who is helping serve people or something. And they say, you know, it's finished. We're, you know, it's not going to work now. People are just going to start leaving. And so in verse 4, Jesus says unto her, "Woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour has not yet come." And so really he's just saying, I guess it sounds kind of curt here. It is kind of a curt statement, a short statement, but obviously not mistreating his mom. We can't accuse the Lord of doing that. But he's simply saying, you know, really, Mom, you're kind of bringing me into a situation ahead of the time here. My public ministry is not yet really getting off the ground. Mine hour has not yet come, he says. And so, you know, he makes that to be understood. But actually, the Apostle John, as we'll see later on, says this was the beginning of the miracles that he did. This is kind of the preview of what is going to come, that this great miracle happened. And this is part of John's purpose, to record these miracles so that people will believe in the Lord Jesus Christ. So his mom comes to him and says they have no wine. Well, what does she expect that he's going to do about it? How does she know that he can quickly solve this problem? You know, there's no store that they're going to go run to and quickly get this resupply. I wonder if she remembered back, way back, when she remembered stored up those things in her heart, that this child was not just a normal child. And maybe he had to, probably, I mean, maybe, I'm sure he had exhibited very, I mean, from a human perspective, strange characteristics of knowing things and understanding things and being able to have wisdom and foresight and vision. And maybe he had even done some things around their home that were just inexplicable apart from his deity. I don't know. But she obviously knows that there's something that he can do for them in their situation. So, verse 5, "His mother said unto the servants, Whatsoever he says to you, do it." What trust! You know, whatever he says to you, if it sounds crazy, don't worry, just do what he says. There's great trust and great understanding that what the Lord says, what her son says, goes. I mean, you know, what? That's kind of strange if, you know, whatever he says to you, do it. You wouldn't say that about every son that a mother has had, would you? Whatever he says, just do it, you know. No, so that's the setup for the situation here, the lack of wine. And so it says now in verses 7 and 8, here's the miracle. Jesus said unto them, verse 6, and there were set there 6 water pots of stone after the manner of the purifying of the Jews, containing 2 or 3 firkins apiece. And so the stage is set here. There, somewhere around this marriage celebration, were 6 large containers. And your translation may say something about 20 to 30 gallons of water. So if you can imagine 20 to 30 gallons, I don't know how big that would be, you know. That thing that we had the lemonade in yesterday was, the bigger one was about 8 gallons. So take that and multiply it up by maybe 3, and there were 6 of those things, these water pots of stone. Now that would make a total of anywhere from 120 to 180 gallons, if I did my math right, 120 gallons to 180 gallons of water that they had to fetch. Because he says to them now in verse 7, fill the water pots with water. And they filled them up to the brim. So they didn't, you know, halfway do what the Lord asked. They did it all the way. But this is a tremendous amount of water that they must have had to get from somewhere. I mean, they had to carry all this. A gallon of water weighs how much? You know, about 8 pounds or something like that. So you multiply that all out, they're hauling a lot of water to get this task accomplished. Just to give you an idea, you remember the horse trough that we have in the back? That's 250 gallons. So take that and imagine it from half to about two-thirds full of water. That's how much water they had to get. And it takes a long time to fill that up with the water hose and a correspondingly long time to drain it out, of course. But that's how much water it was. And so they filled them up to the brim. In verse 8, now, so the miracle has already occurred by the end of verse 7 and the beginning of verse 8. It says that the Lord told them, draw out now and bear to the governor of the feast. So you can imagine them getting there, whatever they do to get out a serving size of this water. And take it to the governor of the feast, the head, you know, the head cook, the chef, or whatever, and take it to him. And so they did it. They took it to him. Verse 9 tells us that when the ruler of the feast, you know, the governor of the feast, had tasted the water that was made wine, so now we get the miracle here. It tells us right what it was. And he did not know where it came from, you know, whence it was. But the servants which drew out the water knew. The governor of the feast called the bridegroom. And so he's stunned. Where did this come from? We were just out. It was all a panic. And now all of a sudden, it's here. We've got 150 gallons of this stuff. We're never going to run out now. Plenty. And so he called the groom over, and he said to him in verse 10, every man at beginning does set forth good wine, and when men have well drunk, then that which is worse. So the normal practice is you get people to drink a bunch, and that will kind of dull their taste buds some. And then you put out the inferior quality, and nobody's, I guess, supposed to be the wiser as to the fact that that happened. But, he says, you have kept the good wine until now. Well, of course, the groom didn't know anything about it. What do you mean the good wine until now? I didn't even know we had any extra wine. But, so the headmaster here is saying, look, you did everything in reverse. You left the best until last, which most people don't do. So, I mean, that's basically the description of the miracle and the astonishment that follows after that. And, you know, we don't know what happened beyond that, how long the marriage celebration went on. These were typically long celebrations, not just an hour or two. And so that's the miracle. We talked about in Sunday school from Exodus, what happens if you don't believe in miracles? What happens to your view of the Bible if you don't believe in miracles? Well, you just take it as myth, I guess, legend, fancy stories, you know, fables that have some lesson, but they're not really true. Well, I appreciate fables and all that, but you know, if a fable says it's not a fable, then it's not telling you a good lesson. You know, it's obviously misleading you if it really is a fable. Well, the scriptures are not, of course. We do believe in miracles. God, because He is God, can intervene in the world in ways that are outside of our, they're just outside of normal. They're outside of the natural laws. Water does not morph into wine, no matter how long you wait or how much it evolves. Okay? It just does not happen. It may get moldy and musty and stinky, but it won't turn into wine. It won't turn into a sweet beverage from the vine. And so we just simply take it as it is at face value. And in fact, that's what John wants us to do. He tells us again, we can't get past this. These things are written that you might believe on the name of the Son of God, that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through His name. So very clear. And then that's what he says in verse 11. This beginning of miracles did Jesus in Cana of Galilee and manifested forth His glory, and His disciples believed on Him. After this, He went down to Capernaum, He and His mother and His brethren and His disciples, and they continued there not many days. So again, as I said, this is kind of the beginning point of His miracles that we know of. It initiates kind of His miracle ministry, if you will. Many of them occur beyond this point. There are a bunch of them in the Gospel of John. And it says that there are two reasons why this miracle really occurred. One was that it would manifest forth His glory. Manifest forth His glory. So it would show what? That He is the Christ, the Son of God. That He is who He said He is. He is who He claimed to be. And secondly, it says, and His disciples believed on Him. So the Lord didn't just do a miracle to do a miracle. Not just for the fun of it, but He had a purpose in doing that. The purpose to manifest His glory, for one, and secondly, to cause His disciples to believe in Him. You'd certainly have to have a pause if somebody changed water into wine, just like that. So, and He didn't even say anything. I mean, He just said, fill up these water pots with water. And then it just happened. Poof, as it were. Now, that's the text. So, just to back up from that for a second and ask the question that many people ask, so what about us? Should we drink wine? Did Jesus drink wine after all? Well, I mean, it doesn't say that He did here. I don't think, does it? I guess the assumption is that He did if He was at the wedding. I'm not saying that's a bad assumption, but I mean, what is this wine? Do you think it was like heavy duty stuff? I don't think so. Let me share with you a couple of things to help you understand. Go back to Numbers chapter 6. Numbers chapter 6. It was always the case in the scriptures that what is called strong drink is strictly forbidden. Looked at as just part of paganism to be involved in strong drink. Now, I'm going to tell you right now ahead of time so you know what my understanding of this is. There's no place in the scriptures that tell us thou shalt not drink any beverage that has any amount of fermentation. But there is also no verse in the scripture that says thou shalt drink any amount of beverage that has fermentation. And that's the point that many people miss. They say, well, the Bible doesn't forbid it, so, you know, drink up. No. It takes a little bit more discernment than that to make a case for it. Now, the scriptures do very plainly indicate that godly people partook of the fruit of the vine. But, now there's a lot of caveats. We'll get to them. I do not drink alcohol at all. Now, why do I do that? One, I was brought up that way. Two, I think the Scriptures teach us and we apply them with godly wisdom in a way that tells us we should not participate. Three, the Scriptures do, if you were on a road and one way was go ahead and partake in alcohol and the other one was not partake, where do the Scriptures steer us? Off to the one not to. They never tell us to go in this direction. Thirdly, or third, fourth, whatever my numbering is here now, it doesn't matter. I also do that for a testimony to people. I've had numbers and numbers of times where people, ask me when I'm at a, especially when I was before in the computer engineering field, when I'd be at a conference or something like that, and everybody'd be going out to have a beer, or the meeting would actually be in a bar or something like that or whatever, and I just wouldn't partake. That gave me many opportunities as a testimony, and a testimony of purity and trying to be separate from the things of the world. There's many reasons built into these as well, which I can talk about, obviously not with the time that we have. Also, the leadership covenant of our church says that we will not participate in that in alcoholic beverage. Just plain and simple, among a number of other things. I also signed a statement regarding that same thing when I went to seminary. And so I'm perfectly happy to abide by what I said because of the principles on which I believe those things. So if you come to me and ask me, should I or shouldn't I will say you should not. It's very easy when you boil it down. But there are good reasons why. Consider Numbers chapter 6. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, when either a man or a woman shall separate themselves to vow a vow of a Nazarite, to separate themselves to the Lord, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink, and shall drink no vinegar of wine or vinegar of strong drink, neither shall he drink any liquor of grapes, nor eat any moist grapes or dried. Man, raisins, I can't eat raisins. That's what it's saying. Not dried, not moist, not whatever. So he was, see, the point of the Nazarite was he wasn't to get even close to the things that came from grapes. Not even the dried ones. Now, I like raisins, but and grapes, too. But this says that the Nazarite in the Old Testament was one who separated himself from all of that. The point that I was drawing out from here, though, was there is wine and there is strong drink. And he is to separate himself from both of those. But strong drink is what's obviously, much more alcoholic than wine here, for one thing. You know, there's several other passages that indicate the same thing, that the wine in the Scriptures is, well, diluted, if you will. It's basically juice. I can't guarantee that it has no atom of fermented stuff in it. But, you know, when it says to the pastors, when Paul says to the pastors that they must be ones that don't linger long at the wine, it says they're not given to wine. It really means they don't linger long at the bottle. They don't linger long at the wine. Why? It's so watered down, they'd have to linger long at the wine in order to get intoxicated. And they're not to be involved in that at all. Acts chapter 2 gives us another indication. Remember when the apostles are speaking in tongues and some of the people are saying, those people are drunk. Peter gets up and he says, look, it's only 9 o'clock in the morning. I mean, these people haven't had time to do that because of the kind of wine that it was. Proverbs 23 says the same sort of thing. So that's one distinction that you have to keep in mind. The wine that we talk about in the Bible is not strong drink type of wine. The wine that is available today, I don't know all the technical specifications, but I think it would qualify as strong drink, actually, with the percentage of alcohol that it has. The kind of wine at which we're speaking in the Scriptures is, as far as we can tell, probably less by far alcoholic than beer, which is about 4%. And so it's not even of that caliber. Now, in the book of Proverbs, go forward to there, somebody is going to say, or object perhaps, what about Proverbs 31? It tells us in Proverbs 31, verse number 4. Oops, turn the page here. Proverbs 31, 4. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes strong drink. Now there's a great word for prince. What are princes? Young kings, young men. And you know their reputation to party or whatever. They have all the money and all the free time. But they're not to be involved in that. Lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the judgment of any of the afflicted. Give strong drink unto him that is ready to perish, and wine to those that be of heavy hearts. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his misery no more. So the Bible is giving us here the notion of what? Use for wine. The medicinal use. Now, do we use that today? Well, no. There are other drugs. If you're at the bedside of someone who is dying, they will often be given morphine or something like that to eliminate the pain and the suffering that is associated with the process of dying. And here, you know, it's saying that they remember their misery no more. So it's talking about the medicinal use of this. This is not the normal use. This is not, you know, this is, what am I trying to say? This is not the normal situation. The Bible is not advocating the use of that for just everyday living. It's for extenuating circumstances at a time when they had nothing else of that sort available. Of course, today we have gobs of other medicines available. Let me ask you to turn over to 1 Timothy 5. And this one, there's a couple of ways to look at this verse, both helpful, and I wanted to share those with you. In 1 Timothy 5 and verse 23, another verse that references the medicinal use of wine, the Scriptures say here, Paul writing to Timothy, drink no longer water, but use a little wine for your stomach's sake and thine often infirmities. And so this is where we get into the issue of dirty water and purification of that water by a little bit of fermentation to clear it and to use this wine for that help. Again, it's a medicinal use. It's not the normal use. It's not a normal situation. And so people will say, hey, look, Paul tells Timothy, go ahead. But it's not the normal situation again. It's a situation in which Timothy is ill and he needs some assistance. We wouldn't use that today for, things that happen to you with dirty water. You'd use some other medication. But let me look at it from a different angle. Why would Paul tell Timothy to, really what it says is, stop drinking only water and take a little wine? Well, by the way, I forgot to say, what does it say? How much wine? A little. Just a little. Okay, side note. But why would he say to stop drinking only water and use a little wine? Because Timothy was only using water. Timothy apparently had made it his practice as a man of God, as one who wanted to be like the Nazarite perhaps, or the priests in the Old Testament, or maybe the Rechabites, remember them? They were commended for their not using alcohol, obviously I have another example. Oh, yeah, John the Baptist, of course. He was not to have any of that stuff. So Timothy had made a decision in his mind that as a believer and as a pastor, he was not going to partake of alcohol. So much so that he would become sick because of that. Probably the normal practice was what Paul is saying here. Use a little bit of that to purify the water and make it so you won't get ill. But Timothy stepped back and said, no, I'm not going to do that. So Paul has to actually instruct him to tell him, add a little bit of that to your diet to help you so that you don't become sick. So I think this is an excellent example. If it's not needed, then the normal practice for a pastor especially, and I think believers are in general held to the same kind of thing. I mean, what is a pastor, one who has these characteristics in 1 Timothy 3, which, you know, he's able to teach and different things like that, but he's basically a mature believer. And so Timothy, as an example of one of those mature believers, though a young man, has made a commitment in his mind, I am going to not use alcohol because of all these reasons that, you know, he understands from the scriptures. Where did Timothy come from? You know, do you think that he never had any exposure to that? No. I mean, goodness. I lived a sheltered life as a kid, but I know all about that stuff too. You know, I mean, so he knows, and he made a commitment to drink just water so that he wouldn't offend anybody, cause anybody to stumble, start down the slippery road. It is a slippery road. That's another thing that I could say. I have a bunch more things that I could go over, but somebody starting down that road can often get into trouble. Have you heard of Pastor Bell? Rod Bell was the president of the Fundamental Baptist Fellowship, I think is what it's called. And he had an alcohol problem for years. And it was not made public until just a year or two ago. And he went into treatment for that. He repented of that. But he stepped down from leadership of that ministry. But it was because he was recommended to start doing using a little wine for a medicinal purpose, I believe. I'm not 100% certain, but that's what got started. And then he ended up down into the valley, so to speak, of this problem. And so it does give us pause. I know that in our very own assembly, there are people who have had a problem with alcohol in their past. Why would I want to cause a temptation or a stumbling block in front of that person, even if I could have a drink once in a while? I mean, Paul casts it another way. He says, if my eating meat offends my brother, then I'm not going to eat meat because I love him. And I love the Lord and I don't want to cause him to stumble. Paul, you mean I can't enjoy my steak? In certain contexts, you cannot. You have Christian liberty to not cause your brother to stumble. That's what liberty is given to us for, not as a cloak of licentiousness that is, oh, I'm free, I can do it. But it's freedom from those kind of restraints and allow you to understand that, no, I don't have to because I love my brother, my sister, and I don't want to cause a problem for them. And it's just, you know, really the same thing here. We're not going to change. We're not going to accommodate folks that want to have alcohol. I know a church that did that so that a man could become a deacon and yet maintain his social drinking. And we're just not going to do it. Okay? If you can't hack it, then you can't be in leadership in the assembly here. I've told people that. And so I don't want to seem harsh or anything, but I'm just saying that's what our belief is based on the scripture, briefly. Obviously, there's more we could look at, but there it is. So I hope you understand at least where we're coming from. Okay. See me afterwards if you have any questions. I'd be delighted to talk about it some more and or correspond with you, whatever. But let's have a word of prayer to close.